Mayfly time is the pinnacle for most brown trout anglers, and we're pleased to announce our next Ireland on the Fly Masterclass is focusing on mayfly tactics with international angler, guide and renowned fly tyer Jackie Mahon.
On Thursday the 25th of April at 8 p.m, Jackie will be discussing how to make the most of the conditions, the best flies and methods to use, as well as giving his tips and insights from a lifetime of experience.
So, to join us for this masterclass on Thursday 25th of April, just go to www.irelandonthefly.com/masterclass. Tickets cost €10 and all attendees will get a copy of Jackie's notes as well as access to the recording of the webinar afterwards.
And stay tuned for our masterclasses throughout 2024, covering salmon, rivers, lochs, streamers, lures, dries, everything to make you a better salmon or trout fly angler, helping you to catch more this year and to learn from the best. For more information, email us on info@irelandonthefly.com.
Hello and welcome to the Ireland on the Fly podcast about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland. Myself and Tom mentioned some time ago that we wanted to start a bit of a book club here on the podcast to discuss the best Irish fly fishing books. And so this week we're kicking it off with an episode on Kingsmill Moore's A Man May Fish, the seminal work on fly fishing in Ireland, of course. And to help us give context and background to Kingsmill Moore, we spoke to Patrick Gageby, a barrister and fly angler who also co-wrote the foreword to an edition of O'Gorman's The Practice of Angling in Ireland. Patrick reveals some fascinating first-hand insights about Kingsmill Moore and the places he fished, and it's well worth listening to. But first, Tom, where do you place A Man May Fish in the pantheon of Irish fly fishing books?
I have to say, it has to be up there at number one, without a shadow of a doubt. If you look at how many times the two of us in the podcast, with whoever we've on, I've mentioned it, and we have such a broad range of people to interview, but it's you know, we were talking about it in fly tying, we're talking about it in sea trout fishing, we're talking about it in, you talk about gillies with Jamesy, you know, it just covers so much. It's like, particularly with trout fishing, all right, I will say that, but particularly with trout fishing, it covers nearly everything for the Irish trout angler.
When did you first get your first copy of it?
Well, it was interesting because we were discussing it, and I'd say why afterwards. But the copy I have is an original, and it was my dad's. It's from 1960s, one of the first print, first editions by Harris of London or something. And my dad, it's signed at the bottom, and I signed it then when I was in third year in school, because I had it in school with me. So I've sitting on a Tom Sullivan third year. So that meant I would have started reading that back in 1982.
So did he give it to you or did you rob it for school?
I stole it. Without a doubt. But the only thing was, my dad loved his fishing, wasn't a great book reader. And particularly with fishing, more into mechanics and things like that and cars. Definitely read up about that. But the odd copy of Trout and Salmon, the odd bit. But so it wasn't missed. I mean, to be honest with you, and another one we got, they had an original copy of Barker's An Angler's Paradise.
What year was that?
That was 1927, which I still have. And whatever way it was printed, some of the pages were still joined. I actually had to cut them. They'd fold over, and they were still joined. So that'll just tell you, I wasn't a huge, huge book reader. Liked his fishing, no doubt, and knew of Kingsmill Moore and everything. Don't think he ever met him or anything. Pa would have been more Ina. And Kingsmill Moore would have been fishing Costello at the times, even though there might have been a small crossover. But hands up, I stole it.
And I presume you were there like either in the evening time or in the back of class kind of flicking through it, was it?
Yeah. Very interesting one about back of class. I'm going to digress a bit. But Roger O'Neill and myself, Roger comes fishing with me every May all the time. But we're in the back of Irish class once, and Fred the head came, the Irish teacher, Fred Murray, and he spotted us at the back that we had this glossy mag, and he came storming down, ripped the magazine off us and looked at it as if to say, I've got you. And like I think with the glossy mag, I think I know what he expected.
What is this filth?
And it was trout fisherman. With some guy holding a big rainbow trout on the cover. And he looked at the cover and he looked at the two of us and more or less said, God, you're sad. And threw it back at us. So, yeah. So needless to say, I never brought man-made fish into class, but I did bring trout fisherman.
Good. And tell me this, at home, like you said, was there growing up, there wasn't a huge amount of fly fishing books on the shelves? Like,
There wouldn't have been a huge amount. No, there wouldn't have been a huge amount. No, just a couple. So, yeah, no, I started it then. So I started reading at 15. When did you get into it?
Kingsman Moore was, it was really only when I first started taking up fly fishing was about 15 years ago. And as I said, there was two books that was kind of basically recommended to me. One was Peter O'Reilly's Fly Fishing in Ireland. And then the other book, the name that kept coming up was Kingsman Moore's Man Made Fish. And for me, what it really whetted my appetite was, and I think it's for some people, mate, but you can either pick up everything between the flies, the kind of scientific side or the kind of cultural romanticism of the fishing. And for me, it was the stories of fly fishing out the West. Like, you know, I've always had a grow. My mum's family's from outside Oranmore. So I've always had a grow for the Connemara in the West. And it was, like I said, it was like harking back to, and I think I was probably naive enough at that stage when I first started going, Jesus, the fishing, I have to get out there. It sounds brilliant. Not realizing it had changed quite a bit since the 1960s. It's one of those I always dip in and out of it, I find.
One that you can dip in and out of, isn't it?
Yeah. And even like just in advance of talking to Patrick, like I fixed it in about 24 hours. I was able to just, and it's easy reading, you know, and it's the best compliment I think you can always give to a writer. It's easy reading. Like, you
know. Well, that's very interesting. And Patrick says this when we're talking to him, like, and I was just about to say to you, it's such an easy read. But then when he talks about, you know, the legal side of him and how some of the judgments and what he wrote were so clear and precise, you know, and stood the test of time.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting. But I think that harkens back. I mean, not really surprised to hear that when we talk about how easy it is to read and how he's so vivid and gets across the likes of Jamesy or the likes of Fishing Carrickillowalla in the Costello system.
Definitely. And I'd recommend just listening to that. And for the Patrick Gageby interview, it's really interesting. And because of Patrick's own legal background, so he was and it's well worth listening to that part of it, where he's able to talk about Kingsman Moore's legal influence and his standing within legal circles. And like you said, there's crossover there in terms of kind of his own clarity of writing and clarity of thought, I think, which all helped it. So there's there was really interesting parts from Patrick that I don't think I've heard anywhere else, just specifically from the kind of legal aspect. And it gives you kind of a more rounded kind of, I think, picture, an insight into Kingsmill Moore as well. Like,
I definitely felt that, because I was saying, like, you know, wasn't too sure of what type of a man Kingsmill Moore was, you know, a fantastic writer. But he definitely, you know, through some of the things like the nomination when he was going to the Senate and things like, you know, really, it was lovely. It gave me another view or an insight into Kingsmill Moore, the man himself.
Definitely, definitely. Sure, look, let's hear from Patrick now. And I first asked him why a man-made fish remains so influential and important over 60 years since first being published.
I think there's really two things, and they're quite different things. Firstly, Kingsman Moore was a very thoughtful fellow. And he did a lot of thought about flies and fly colours, why a particular fly might work here and work there. Was there, for instance, such a thing as a great Irish fly? And of course, there really was, and he was the progenitor of many of them, the Bumbles and whatnot. But he had a very inquiring mind, and he didn't just read stuff and then regurgitate it. So he observed. He was a very good observer of fisheries, but also of people. So there's a very substantial amount in the book about why do fish take, why does the fly work, why does this fly work and not that fly. And it's all, you know, against a background in which there's an extraordinary amount of, I'm going to say, unscientific storytelling in fly fishing. But this was actually a very rigorous mind at work, and he was very interested in anything to do with fishing and fisheries. But the second part of the book, I find, is much the more charming, is his stories of fishing. Not that he didn't recount how many fish he caught or how many fish he lost, but the fact that he took such enormous joy in the Irish countryside. And anybody who lives in a town or a city like I do, and perhaps ye do as well, knows how wonderful it is and was to get out of town and suddenly to be on a lake beside a river, night or day or whatever, in a completely different world. And, you know, he really captured that. And he did an enormous love of the Irish countryside. You'll also notice when you read the book in its non-technical forms, he's very careful about the place names, which he loved. I mean, he loved the Connemara, the lakes of the plain, as he called them, Fermoil. He talks about Shanawana, Clogher, Carrickkilawalla, and all that sort of stuff. And for a man who was, educated, or secondary school anyway, in Marlborough in England, he was a man who lived through the birth of the state and was a very, very committed and interested part of the state. So really, for me, there are the pen pictures of the places that I myself then went to because he had spoken of them. The Slaney, I fished where he used to fish, in fact, where his mill house was and where everything was washed away in the big flood. I've fished Delphi at a time before it was anything like it currently is. And, you know, you could rent the entire fishery for £150 a week. And you had to share the river with canoeists, poachers, everybody else. I haven't fished some of the Cashlough fisheries and things like that. But why is it important? Because I think it is two quite different strands. Firstly, a very, very beautiful romantic part, and then an incredibly practical one. So that's why I place it.
And it occurred to me just when I was rereading again, and I've read it so many times, but that's what occurred to me exactly, was that you have the scientific, very specific, stuff you can learn. And then you're taken into the kind of literary romanticism of kind of the countryside. So you've got the both. And I often think if the book was just one, had only just been the scientific part, it would have been good. If it had been just the romantic literary part, it would have been good. But the sum of its parts, I think, is what really kind of lifts the book as a whole.
Yeah, that's true. And the other thing is he references quite a lot J.R. Harris or Dick Harris. The angler's entomology. And, you know, that's a very big part of Irish history and fly fishing, because it's Dick Harris's book is a fine book. And I remember him very well from Garnet and Keegan's. And he was a really wonderful old fella. And he knew his stuff. If you said to him, I'm thinking of fishing the Manalty stream, he'd say, well, you should go to this place and that place, and you need to put three flies on the cast, and he gives you the size, the order, and all of those things. And he's usually right as well.
Tom, as a Connemara man, reading about these places, like, does it just stir the heartstrings when you're reading it? Like, you know, does it evoke something?
Well, it's very interesting that you say that, Patrick, about, you know, you got to fish the Slaney places. Yeah. I remember the first time, I've only fished it once. I actually went up to Shanawana to fish it. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to fish it was because of that chapter in A Man May Fish.
Did you bring your ham sandwiches?
I didn't. And I had mucilin at that stage. He didn't have mucilin. That was his fault. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that, with the grease line and the ham sandwiches. Yeah, but all those things. And it's funny that you should say that. It's exactly what I've always thought, because I've reread it a bit, and I've read it so many times just for this. And I was just looking at the, you know, that he got a photographer friend to take infrared photography, of when he was trying to perfect the perfect black body for the Kingsman.
Yeah.
And yet then he talks, as I'm doing a piece, and I may use it, of night fishing on a stream going into Palafuku Reservoir.
Yes.
And it goes that bit of night fishing, you know, where you're almost 1 foot into the, as he says, the land of the gods, and then you're brought back, but you look back into the bleached sand where there might be the hoof mark of goats.
No. Sorry, I'm going to read it. Page 40.
Yeah.
He says, the value of night fishing is as a sedative to fretted nerves and a tired brain. A sedative, yet something more, a portal of escape from the instancy of the present. As the night deepens, the river takes command. Its voice mounts, filling the valley, rising to the rim of the hills. No longer one voice, but 100. Time and place are dissolving. The centuries have lost their meaning. Timelessness is all. 1 foot is crossing the invisible frontier which bounds the land of the old gods. Then comes the whistle of an otter, the bark of a fox, and you're back in the world of sentiency. Almost you fear to turn less black upon the moon-blanched sand. There should be the hoof marks of a goat. And I had remembered from the first and second and tenth time I read it.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
we've all been there. And certainly, if you've ever fished in Connemara for white trout on a warm summer's evening, there's often nearly every one of those things present, including the odd goat.
This is the thing now, because I'm just wondering, because is it just purely a goat? Or here's what I'm thinking. You know, the old Irish pish rogue about, you know, the devil was at the dance hall, right?
Yes, yes, I do, yes.
And that was all that was left when they looked, was there was goat prints where he had stood, because the devil has cloven hoofs as feet.
It might also be Pan, who has goat's feet.
Pan, right. You see, yeah.
It's a possibility. But the thing is, Kingsman Moore was very well educated and very well read, but he didn't parade it, you know. It's nice there. So there's at least two constructions.
But I think that's what you just touched upon between the first and the second part. I think that's why so many people like it.
Yeah.
It appeals to different different strands of the argument. Actually, can I? It's funny, that was one of the thumbed pages I had.
Was it?
Another bit of just speaking of the fairies and all that kind of stuff. It's about Shanawona. It says, where they toiled up the bare granite ribs of the first range. The sun shone hotter than ever. All the color had been bleached out of the countryside. The slippery grass had faded to an ash gray, and over the rich blacks and browns of the peat, a dry gray scurf had spread. The heather was prematurely over, while large patches showed withered and dead. We dared not traverse the slope, for we were following a compass line and had to go straight over everything. Up we went and down we went, to the valley where the Yellow River, a noisome, oily snake of stagnancy, gave us some trouble in crossing, and then at last up onto the final plateau, beyond the crest of which we hoped to find our goal. And then he goes on, but there's a line I love, and it goes, my companion reminded me that we were now in the core of the haunted country, and probably on the fairy high road from Carrow to Ross's. What we were hearing might be fairy music, a theory which at first seemed strengthened when we realized the sound really was coming out of the earth under our feet.
Yes, indeed.
It just brings it there, doesn't it? Like, you know, it's just, and I think part of the other, like Tom, what we were saying there in terms of the lyricism and the poetry of the lines is, it also harks back to, doesn't it, a kind of a lost fishing Eden in many respects, you know, that.
Yes, and that's a phrase he uses when he talks about the end of the two hostelries in Delphi and in Old Head, when Alec Wallace got tired of the regulations from the tourist board and sort of packed off everything and went off to Afghanistan. And he ends that chapter with saying another little Eden had vanished. But of course, the Eden he's describing is really the great company. It's not just that the fishing was good, it's that the company was good and the evenings were pleasurable and there might be stimulating and interesting talk, you know. And one link I have to that is that he mentions frequently his fishing companion, Noel Gogarty, who's the son of Oliver St. John Gogarty. And Noel was in the same line of business that I am. So I got to know him a bit and would often sit in the coffee room and ask him about Delphi in the old days, fishing here, Kingsmill Moor and stuff like that. And like Kingsmill Moor, I think Noel had been possibly educated in Britain, but he certainly spoke with a very polite accent, if I can use that phrase. And again, that's, would have been part of, I suppose, Kingsmill Moor's background. I mean, he had both been educated in England, but had subsequently then gone into Trinity College and become auditor of the College Historical Society, ended up being a senator for about 3 or 4 years, very progressive in his day. I mean, one of the things that's noted, particularly about him is that the second time he stood for the Senate in, I think, 44, all of his nomination papers, he sought to be signed by women, which was, I think, quite unusual in 1940s Ireland. So, it wasn't just about old fellas sitting around moaning about the old days.
And interesting, actually, he does credit his wife.
Very much so, yes.
For pushing him to write this book in the first place, that she is basically the one. And then, of course, this is to the memory of my wife, who made so many fears groundless and so many dreams a reality.
Yeah, and, he does reference the fact that she seems to have spent a lot of time with him in the rowing boat.
Yeah.
Because there is mention that she would be sitting in the prow wrapped in very heavy blankets. And can you imagine, after... hour 7 or 8 of a large bit of rain coming across the Corrib.
Very patient, yeah. I have to say.
Dedication. And he was also, because I was looking up, I never really garnered what Saracen was. And then I looked up Saracen, which is under the original print, it's by T.C. Kingsmill Moore, and it's under Saracen. And he wrote a book of poetry under that name in 1921.
Yes, when he had just come back from the war, finished being the auditor of the HIST, as it's called in Trinity, and was just starting his career at the bar. I haven't read it, I would have to say, but I have read the poetry that's to be found in A Man May Fish. And from the beginning to the end, I think it's really great, including the bit... Requiescam, which suggests that his kindly spirit is looking on where the angler treads along the river.
What the picture I'm getting here is actually may have had a preconceived notion of Kingsmill Moor, that it's not really sticking to it. I mean, when you say with his nomination papers, that he seems to have been, for some reason, I want to say this right, but I'd always thought that he might have been a bit of a stick in the mud, right?
Yes.
And I've tried to put it as well, but obviously I don't think he was he?
No, and, you would have thought, just looking at a very cursory view, that perhaps with all of his background and stuff like that, he'd be rather stuffy. But actually he wasn't. And the Dictionary of Irish Biography entry is written by Jerry Hogan, who's a judge of the Supreme Court. And I mean, he notes that, Kingsmill Moor came back from the war, and within 2 or 3 years, the state had been founded. And he was credited with, being able to adapt and change from the United Kingdom into the Free State and stuff like that. And he was very engaged. I mean, he was a senator for 4 years. He was a correspondent for the Irish Times when he was quite young. And he had quite a broad practice, which was a bit unusual. He didn't just do land cases or accident cases. I mean, he did a couple of murder cases as well. And in the Senate, he was thoughtful, and civilized. One of the things, for instance, that he's referenced as having spoken particularly about in 1946, in one of the debates, he spoke about prison conditions, referencing back some of the IRA prisoners, only one or two, I think, who had gone on hunger strike during the Second War in Ireland. So, I mean, he was not, you might say, a typical son of the of a Church of Ireland clergyman.
I get the sense that he could, whatever he turned his hand to, he did well and he succeeded in whatever he could have put his mind to.
Oh yeah, he was very much one of the leading judges, and his was an important voice because at the time there was a convention that there would always be somebody on the Supreme Court who wasn't Roman Catholic, as people said in those days, and it was a convention. I don't think anybody bothers with that now, but at the time he was. But he was very much an engaged man, engaged in the country, and a very fine judge. Perhaps one of the best amongst about five or six in the last 100 years, the best five or six people for really clear writing and thinking, and not full of false learning, shovel loads of Shakespeare or that sort of stuff, or even Latin.
Is there a sense nearly, and this is very unusual to say when we're talking about a fly fishing, that nearly a man may fish has kind of overshadowed his actual other real accomplishments in life, that he's known for a man may fish as opposed to the legal side of things?
Yeah, well, I have the benefit of being both a lawyer and I used to fly fish quite a lot, so I'm quite happy to have a foot in each camp. No, he was. His judgments were particularly known for being careful and that sort of stuff,
And I also like the fact as well, as that you're saying, like, he came from that kind of, say, actually, where did he grow up? Just, I know we went to school.
South Dublin. He was the father was the head of the Church of Ireland Training College, which would have been for clergy and teachers. And he was brought up in a big house on Mount, just beside Mount Anvil. So they wouldn't have been particularly prosperous, but, they certainly weren't poor if you're sending your son to Marlborough.
Yeah. But he seemed to, like you said, he straddled that kind of divide, didn't he? Like the kind of the coming of the Free State.
Yeah.
The end of one year, the beginning of another. He was able to be, fishing in the big house.
Yeah.
And hanging out with Jamesy. And he was able to kind of converse, whether it was the lords or the peasants, whatever, that he was able to kind of traverse that whole spectrum, really.
Oh, very much so. And, when he talks about visiting the I think it's Kinloch House on Loch Melvin, and he's talking about the old man of the house who had was probably born at the 1820s or 1830s or something like that. That's the end of the old order. And there is some regret for it, but it's only in the personal way,
Tom, there's another thing that strikes me as well about the book as well. And I personally think why as well is we're so fascinated by it is, like you said, he's mentioning, the lord of the house from born in the 1820s, 1830s.
Yeah.
Hark back to that past, and yet he's still in the 20th century and he's seeing the decline begin. It's almost like that window into the kind of that changing moment where, the good old days are gone, and he recognizes it as well. And Tom, like we spoke, Patrick, to Joe Crane, but Joe was talking about, obviously, the kind of what he remembers of the heyday of the sea trout fishing. And Tom, isn't it very much, and like you get that in the book A Man May Fish, where he's talking about the numbers of fish that could be caught. Yeah. And even he's decrying what was like 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Because he witnesses, and we talked to Joe, and Joe witnessed it. But, he talks about the blue ribbon fisheries, and going back, and like, well, would you get even a quarter? If you got a quarter of what is it, 40 sea trout, isn't it, to be in the Blue Ribbon Club. And they had to be good sea trout. Like, if you got a quarter of that on any of those lakes these days, you'd be considering yourself to have one heck of a day, you know?
Yeah, and if you kept him, you'd be in jail. No, I mean, I have, I only really started fishing about 1980. So I just saw really the end of the stuff around Loch Aina and Derry Clare and that. But I just have wonderful memories of, you know, going out, setting up tackle at about 10 o'clock, waiting for it to get dark, hearing, you know, the way the sea trout, you can sometimes jump straight out just, and you know there's a school passing through. I mean, that was just wonderful. And then go off for a drink in, I don't know, Ballinhinge Castle or the, or, you know, Della Macaulay's.
Della's. With the question, you've been in Della's,
Oh, yeah, no, I say that. And I was very friendly with Della right until she died. She was a great angler. There's a rock, actually, in the bay below her, her old cottage called Della's Rock. Because, I mean, she was fishing since she was a sort of a slip of a girl, really, you know?
No.
I mean, just fantastic.
Patrick, tell me, yeah, so you grew up in Dublin yourself as well. So how did you get into fly fishing and what's your own background doing?
Yeah, well, my father did a tiny bit. My brother did quite a bit more. But actually, it was my grandfather, who was called Sean Lester, who was High Commissioner for the League of Nations in Danzig and then in, worked in Geneva during the Second War. But he retired. He loved fishing, but got no access to it for many years. So he bought the old station house in Recess. So as you travel west past Joyce's, on your left-hand side is the old station house. And that was, the railway finished in 36, maybe 37. So he bought there with my grandmother in 1953. And he then died in 59, actually driving up the Aina Valley on a June afternoon. And I actually have memories from the late 50s of being there. And he was a very keen angler. So he had the fishing on Glendalough, the Lahana Locks, a bit of the Recess River, and a bit of the river that goes out from Glendalough into Derry Clare. So that I would actually think was the original spark, as it were.
And is that where you loved fishing, the kind of down the west, down Connemara, that was your kind?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I spent nearly every weekend that I could, and when I could get longer, I did. And I'd hop in the car at 5 o'clock on a Saturday morning to fish the Derry Clare butts later, you know. So that and Della's, you know, the sort of comradely nature of the thing. It wasn't particularly posh, neither the fishing nor the Della's place, but it was great fun.
That's an understatement.
It was, you know, so this was my sort of Delphi or Alec Wallace sort of stuff. Not quite the same level of sort of a Nobel laureates around the dinner table, but you know.
Did King's Memoir's reputation precede him as an angler, like at, you know, by that stage, like that?
Definitely. And he mentions a couple of his other colleagues who were well-known fishers. And clearly King's Memoir had also read O'Gorman, because he talks about the old beats on the Shannon fished around that time and all that sort of stuff, you know.
I was just going to ask you that. That was just leading into that, Patrick. So we have probably Kingsman Moore, I would say, like, probably the best Irish angling author, without a doubt. Who else would you put up there with them?
Well, I mean, I still have a great draw for O'Gorman. I mean, any man who can, like O'Gorman. Now, I haven't actually read it since Kevin McKenna and myself did the foreword what's that, 30 years ago, is it?
Yep, 30 years ago. 29, actually, 1993. I have it here beside me.
Okay. But there's a description there of where they go to either a tavern or a tent and they get drunk and they break all the crockery in the place and they are ashamed in the following morning, you know. That I find wonderful. But also his, I think it's O'Gorman's fierce opinions, you know. He strongly is against this and that. And, you know, Kingsmill Moore had a bit of that, and I would share a bit of it. He talks about the melancholy art of dapping.
And, you know, he had no time for it.
Most things, but dapping, I think he would have a higher opinion of somebody who was gaffing fish under a bridge. Those who dap.
Well, there's two things you had to do for dapping, which I've forgotten, but he said, I might add a third, don't fall asleep.
That's right, And sorry, the other books, a particularly beautiful book, at one stage I had two of them, The Urn, It's Legends and Fly Fishing.
Rowlands, not sure.
Newland,
sorry, excuse me. Yeah. I've never read it. Is it good?
I haven't read it in an awful long time. It's one of the most beautiful books ever produced, because on the front cover there is a beautiful engraving on the leather of a fairy fly, as it was called, which was to symbolize the most effective fly on the Urn when it was one of the best salmon rivers in the United Kingdom, you know. And that's an amazing book. But again, suffers from the a little bit of a sort of an Anglocentric view. So the peasantry are interesting, but clearly of a different caste. But there again, the book was written in what, 1860 or something like that.
I remember you actually said that in your foreword that you did for the O'Gorman, that basically it was the first book that was really written by an Irish author. Up to then you had Belton. A couple others, and basically they were tourists as such, and looking with a bit of looking down on the peasantry. But
I suppose that is partly then the kind of attraction then, isn't it, of A Man May Fish, because you do get that sense of this is a learned man at the top of his game, but very much from an Irish perspective, like real pride in what he's doing. One thing we haven't mentioned yet, you know, it's obviously a big part of the book, is his flies, the influence he had. And Tom, talk to us there about, you know, the flies.
Well, it's because I was just going to bring it up. I mean, I think, and I don't know, we've done quite a few podcasts even this summer, and I think we keep going back to it for various things. And the last podcast we did just before this was with Jackie Mahon, Fly Tire. And he's talking about dying. And of course, we brought up the one about the jackass
urine. Rogan's.
But it's just back into that we're always going back to him for certain things. And for fly tying, we really, you know, I mean, like the Bumbles. I mean, they're still catching fish. Yeah. They're still catching not just the odd fish, lots of fish. Okay, there's a bit of variance. Guys might be throwing hopper legs onto them, might be putting a tag of fluorescence on the back, but ostensibly it's still the same pattern in the middle, you know.
It is like was it you telling me though, Tom, in the book, is I'm trying to remember, he mentions the English flies are like soldiers uniforms, I think. Was that the
soldiers in uniform on parade? And basically what he's saying is, what we're saying, that when you hold them up to the light they're opaque, right? When you hold an Irish fly up to the light, it's translucent. The light comes through it, and it takes on a whole different look. The colors mingle, all the different colors, and that's what he was saying was the beauty of it. He says while the opaque ones may work on the point, because I was just looking at it again, he says the English flies, he said, could probably match the Irish flies. Once you went up to the droppers, you had to have the Irish flies on. He said.
Tell us, Patrick, just in terms of The kind of, I suppose, looking on it overall, like we've mentioned how there's so many bits that you can take and that people are attracted to. It's the, you know, whether it's the science, whether it's the flies, whether it's the characters, you know, whether it's the stories. Do you think we'll be still talking about A Man May Fish in 50, 100 years' time, like in terms of its influence?
Oh, gosh, I hope so. Because what really, I was surprised in, I have my own copy of the second edition, but I just put his name in on the various booksellers, you know, 8 books and things like that. My goodness, there's an awful lot of the third or the most recent edition out there, and seems to be a very popular book. And, you know, I mean, I think anybody who fishes, you know, really, really likes the countryside. I mean, nobody else is going to sit on a boat for 6 or 8 hours on the lake except an angler or, you know, some type of nutter. Or do the same, but you know, in what passes for the Irish spring, you know, one of those days when there's hail and rain and then a northwest wind and you're out looking for a salmon in March or April, you know. It's nobody else goes to the places that anglers go, thankfully.
And I think, like, I thank everyone who pointed it in my direction when I first started fly fishing, because it just brings you to this world that you kind of go, wow, you know, this is what it could have been like, you know, or could be like, you know, in your kind of wildest dreams. Yeah, and it really sucks you in.
While we're on the other books there, and I just bring it up because another book, it's almost like a contemporary at the time, was Fishing and Thinking, Patrick.
Yeah.
Dr. A.A. Luce.
Yeah, I was about to say that, yeah, because, I mean, they were both very good thinkers. And for Luce, Loch Conn was the big place. He used to fish out of Clohans with, I think, Pat Kelly. And he has all the stories from Loch Conn. But I think Luce was a great expert on Berkeley and philosophy and that sort of stuff. He was actually, I remember seeing him, he was quite ancient by the time I was in college, and he would occasionally totter across the
The front track.
But that is actually a really fine book.
Patrick, it's been absolutely fascinating. Just talking about any excuse to talk about A Man May Fish in Kingston.
I love it.
It's great, like, and especially these winter nights, you know, this is what you want. You've told us a little bit about your own kind of fishing career.
Yeah.
Do you have a memorable fish? We ask it of every guest at the end. Do you have a memorable fish that stands out for you?
Oh, well, I obviously remember my first salmon, which was quite late. It was in 1986. And that was at Greenpoint on the Ballinhinch system, just at the bottom of Derry Clare. But actually, the fish I remember most about is the one that I am most ashamed of, because I was on Corrib with a friend of mine who had introduced me to Corrib, knew quite a lot, you know, around Portacarron. The day was very, there was very little wind. We went across the lake towards, I think, Inchmacatrier. And we were on the way back, and it was absolutely flat calm. So he said, listen, throw out a trolling rod. So I threw out the spoon or whatever it was on it. And within 10 minutes, I had a 10-pound, 5-ounce brown trout. Now, I should say, not only is dapping the melancholy art, you could say the same for trolling if we want to be snobbish about such things.
Oh, I agree.
The last time I've trolled, and that was, I think, 1988, maybe.
Yeah.
Double figure, though.
Double figure brownie, hey?
Yeah, actually, I think I would go trolling once if I knew I was going to get a double figure brownie. Like,
yeah. Yeah, if it's double figure, it's well worth it.
Before I let you go, I just want to finish on reading out Requiescam. And Kingsman Moore wrote this. Do you have it there, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm just looking for the page number.
Yeah, I'd love you to, if we could finish on that.
Because
we spoke about Kingsmill Moore's writings, and to me, this is, like, to come at the end of, you know, 200-odd pages of, you know, pure brilliant.
Yeah, I have it here. Will I read the whole lot?
Yeah, please do.
Here.
Okay. Bear my body when I die, far from men, and let it lie by a salmon river, where the larches troop their ranks, and above the grand banks, silver birches shiver. Stay not, stranger, passing by, for decorous lament or sigh. Where I rest beside you, go, my brother, cast your line with the craft that once was mine, and good luck betide you. There, who knows, I still may ply, or the stream a phantom fly for a midnight capture. And if heaven attends my wish, bring to bank a ghostly fish in a ghostly rapture. Requiescam. Sinead.
Sinead. Patrick Gageby, thank you very much for your time. It's been fantastic chatting to you.
Likewise. Good luck. Bye.
Our thanks to Patrick Gageby for joining us on the show. And don't forget to rate, review, and follow the Ireland on the Fly podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Plus, you can keep up to date on IrelandOnTheFly.com as well as on Instagram. And myself and Tom will be back with another episode about the people and places of fly fishing in Ireland. Mayfly time is the pinnacle for most brown trout anglers, and we're pleased to announce our next Ireland on the Fly Masterclass is focusing on mayfly tactics with international angler, guide and renowned fly tyer Jackie Mann.
On Thursday the 25th of April at 8 p.m, Jackie will be discussing how to make the most of the conditions, the best flies and methods to use, as well as giving his tips and insights from a lifetime of experience.
So, to join us for this masterclass on Thursday, 25th of April, just go to www.irelandonthefly.com/masterclass. Tickets cost €10 and all attendees will get a copy of Jackie's notes as well as access to the recording of the webinar afterwards.
And stay tuned for our masterclasses throughout 2024, covering salmon, rivers, lochs, streamers, lures, dries, everything to make you a better salmon or trout fly angler, helping you to catch more this year and to learn from the best. For more information, email us on info@irelandonthefly.com.